Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring a discussion of U.S. foreign policy and commentary by Lamont Colucci of Ripon College, Arthur Sear of Carthage College, and Nafari Zafari of the Iranian-American Council. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's west side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it is beyondthebeltway.com. Well, when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, everyone wondered how long it would take before Bill Clinton sort of horned in on her territory. Well, as you know, former President Bill Clinton was in North Korea last week, and he was able to bring back with him two young journalism students who had been detained by the North Koreans. Now, again, this was viewed as a big success because, again, two Americans were freed and they are now back home. But some are suggesting whether or not Bill Clinton might have been used by the North Korean dictator and leader. So we're going to be talking about that in the first portion of our program this evening. But as the program unfolds tonight, we're going to be talking about all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. I'd like to begin by getting a reaction on Bill Clinton going to North Korea. Your reaction, Art Sear from Carthage College. Well, was he used or was it a plus?
I think it was a plus for the United States and for the U.N., which is of principal importance in the increasingly isolated U.N. North Korean regime. I think capturing, abusing, and some level trying to exploit especially two young female journalists was a big mistake. Bill Clinton quite wisely said nothing, very unusual for those of us who had a chance to listen to as well as hear the president these many years. He was in front of a microphone. He said nothing. It's great. Terrific, given the circumstances.
Lamont Colucci also joins us. He is with Ripon College. He's written a new book called Crusading Realism, also an expert in foreign affairs and foreign policy. Your reaction to Bill Clinton?
I think it was a success at the personal level in bringing out Una Lee and Lisa Ling. And so we can be glad as Americans that two Americans were freed. But I think it's unfortunate in the sense that it does add legitimacy to the most reprehensible regime on planet Earth. And what's lost in many of the articles you'll see.
And you're talking about North Korea's.
That's correct. That's correct, of course. What's lost in many of the articles you'll see in the New York Times or other places is an absence from a discussion of the human rights situation in North Korea for the people of North Korea. And I think that's lost in much of the celebration and discussions right now.
Nariman Safari also joins us. Nariman, nice to have you with us. Your reaction to the movement into North Korea by President Clinton?
I don't think talking to anyone necessarily adds legitimacy to them. It's just the realization that they are an entity and a fact to deal with. President Clinton was the last president that had that relationship with North Korea in a halfway stable and reasonable status. And he has a lot of prestige on that issue. So I think it was a brilliant move to actually have him try to deliver.
Now, he was asked for, according to what Hillary Clinton said on CNN today. I mean, Nim Jalkil, he asked, it was passed through those that were being detained, that they wanted Bill Clinton. So, I mean, he Kim Jong-il got exactly what he wanted. So is it, from a negotiating standpoint, does he get some plus for this? He had 3 hours?
Bill Clinton or Kim Jong-il?
No, Kim Jong-il. I mean,
he looked sick. We saw Bill Clinton and Al Gore hug each other in Slavia. That was a major breakthrough at some level. But, no, I think the former president handled it extremely well. He was formal. He was pro forma. He didn't in any way embrace this weak and insipid-looking North Korean leader. When you have to take advantage of two young women like this, I think the imagery as well as reality is terrible. Although Professor Colucci makes a very good point about the human rights record in North Korea, and it's an opportunity, really, to
Why do you think he picked Clinton? I mean, if America obviously says, you know, we don't, you know, negotiate with terrorists and dictators, but the reality was it behooved the United States government to get these two women back. Did it surprise you that they selected Bill Clinton of all? They could have selected Al Gore. They could have selected someone else with an international reputation.
I think they wanted an American president, and it wasn't going to be either Bush president. So that was out. So the only real option would have been Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was the president that negotiated the 1995 Cato Agreement, which was the last really significant agreement between us and the North Koreans, including the Japanese, as well. And so that framework, that 1990 framework, which kind of built the relationship possibly in a wrong direction, was the legacy of Bill Clinton. And so I don't think that's surprising that they would have chosen him. I think the decision had to be made about whether that was a wise choice or not, and obviously the State Department felt it was.
In addition to North Korea tonight, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. We're going to talk about Pakistan. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most significant or the most dangerous, where would you put North Korea on the most feared nations list at the moment from the United States, Art Zier?
I think they're right up there near, if not at the top, because they do have some sort of primitive nuclear weapons capability. They're also tremendous mischief makers. They have a huge role in the international black market, not just weapons, but liquor, drugs, tobacco, women, counterfeit currency, you name it.
They're not afraid of anybody.
I think they're increasingly fearful because they're so weak, but they're willing to be very assertive, more than these other states, on a global stage. And you make a very good point in the sense that there is a ferocious warrior tradition in both halves of Korea, and they aren't afraid at that level. They're willing to take risks.
Where would you put them, Dr. Colucci?
I would agree. I think they're up at near the top. Oh, I mean, if I'm Japan, it's 10 for sure, in particular.
That's a good point.
There's no question that for the Japanese, this is the threat, security threat for sure. They're not necessarily a direct national security threat to the vital interests of the United States, but they're definitely a threat to the national interests of the United States and our allies. And if you look at it, nothing has really changed since 1953. I think that's the other context we have to remember, that the North Koreans have a cycle of negotiation and then attempts to derail negotiations, then attempts to threaten, and then to go back to negotiations in an effort to get concessions, which they've been extraordinarily successful at. And that's really been a pattern since 1953. It's an incredible cycle. You can actually look at a model that goes over and over and over again, and we're seeing it again right now.
Mr. Safari, does a dying dictator, does that make him more dangerous?
It seems like it, because that's a regime that's a very reprehensible regime, and there doesn't seem to be any method of governance or accountability within that system. So as to who will come back on top and what kind of imaginations are going on inside of that regime is unknown to people outside, and you never know what may come out of that.
Art Zier.
Mr. Safavi's point reinforces the reality that the army is the crucial instrument in keeping the ruling family in power, like some sort of medieval set of warlords passing power. It's the army. That's the one instrument that's left that's really crucial. But they've captured people historically, the Pueblo in 1968, the abuse of Korean War prisoners, which resonated in American politics in frightful ways during the McCarthy period. I do think they're less fearful from our point of view. And the tremendous economic success as well as political democracy in South Korea is crucial there.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8229. When we come back, next stop, Afghanistan.
As a Major League Baseball umpire for over 30 years, I've learned focus is everything. That's why I switched to a complete multivitamin with more. Only one a day Men's 50 Plus Advantage has both ginkgo for memory and concentration, plus support for heart health. Centrum can't give you all that. And in this game, I want every advantage.
One a day Men's 50 Plus Advantage, the official multivitamin of Major League Baseball.
Introducing the Ally Bank 12-month high-yield CD with such a great annual return of 2% APY, people think there's a catch. But no, no catch, no teaser rate, no limited time offer, no fine print, jargon, or legalese, no hidden tricks, traps, pitfalls, curveballs, or doublespeak. Just a 12-month high-yield CD with a rate that's among the most competitive in the country. Call Ally at 877-247-ALLY or go to allybank.com. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.
From Madison, Wisconsin to Manchester, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Let's go to Oak Brook, Illinois, where Ed is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I just want to say one of the reasons I think they picked President Clinton to be the spokesmodel for to get the girls out was, here you got a guy that lied to the world saying he didn't have sex with that woman, so now you got one liar and you got the Korean liar. Now who's the world going to believe? How do you know Clinton's going to apologize for Americans' past transgressions against North Korea?
Well, I think if he had done that, Kim Jong-il would have already made a point of that. The point is he had 3 hours of Bill Clinton's time, and based on what Bill Clinton normally charges per hour, it's probably a pretty good deal. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Jim in South Elgin, also on WLS. You're on the air.
Good evening. I think Bill Clinton went over there and was able to get back a favor that he'd done for the North Koreans when he gave them all that nuclear or all that missile technology and things with the Loral space station when he was getting money for campaigns.
That's an allegation that's never been proven, and it was actually an allegation involving China, which is a pro forma ally of North Korea, but China's been a very important ally of ours in the U.N. in pressuring North Korea in this matter.
They got a lot of money from the for the campaign, and they shouldn't have given those.
North Koreans gave money to the Clinton people?
Well, through the Buddhist temple and through the Chinese and all this other network of a flow of money.
Well, I guess that's an important subject, but it's not directly related to North Korea. That's why we have these public affairs programs.
They got the missile technology, sir, and it didn't come out of the clear blue sky. Bill Clinton gave it to him.
Ambassador Laney was nice enough to meet with me in Seoul, Korea, Clinton's ambassador to Korea. I was very, very fortunate to be able to talk with him during the time of our nuclear detente when we had inspectors going in there. And he said the most frightening thing was the primitive nature of North Korean technology. Our people had to bring their own power systems in because in the nuclear reactor itself, the light bulbs would dim and go on. There'd be sparks flying. He said it was so primitive, that was really the most frightening aspect of this North Korean tinkering with nuclear weapons.
How influential, sir, thank you for calling. How influential has China been, and could China be a lot more influential insofar as North Korea is? And do they have any desire to sort of bring them into the 20th century, let alone the 21st century?
Yes, yes, and yes. They have extremely important, increasingly important, with North Korea's isolation, economic involvement both ways, investment both ways, tremendous aid from China to North Korea. It's important to keep in mind that we did fight a war with China in Korea, a terrible and particularly brutal war. And the Chinese, in effect, have flipped. They're now exercising tremendous pressure on North Korea. Informed speculation is persuasive to me that one reason the famous, notorious ship that was steaming from a North Korean port to Burma turned around during Hillary Clinton's visit was not just that the Secretary of State was shaking her finger publicly at this exercise, but also China put heavy pressure on Pyongyang. And the ship turned around while Hillary Clinton was there. The Chinese have been extremely helpful, I think, to both Clintons in different ways.
Let us move to Afghanistan. And Nariman Safari, let us begin with you. Again, back on that scale of 1 to 10, insofar as trouble spots for the United States, mm-hmm. Where would you put Afghanistan, given the fact that the problems in Afghanistan are rising, not subsiding?
Well, Afghanistan is a deep, deep problem. In terms of what sort of immediate threat it represents to the United States, it's a little bit difficult to assess that. Certainly, what we've learned after 9/11 is that failed states are a threat to us no matter what, anywhere. But in terms of Afghanistan itself being a strategic issue for the United States, it is not as palpable as one might think. However, Afghanistan and Pakistan together all of a sudden represent a big strategic issue for the United States.
Professor Colucci, your answer to that same question.
Well, I would agree. I don't think it's a strategic threat to the United States unless we have a return to pre-9/11 conditions where the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-type franchises are able to operate out of there. And so the question really is for the United States is what is the foreign policy goal in Afghanistan? The first goal has to be stability, and the second goal has to be the eradication of extremist elements like al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The third goal should be the type of government that we want to see in Afghanistan. But the road in Afghanistan is going to be a lot longer than Iraq. And I think Americans need to be well prepared for that to be a very long road. I mean, if you're talking about Iraq within maybe 5 or 10 years or decades, you're probably talking in 20 or 30 or 40-year increments, if not longer, in Afghanistan. And I think that road is something the United States needs to commit to, and there can't be vacillation in the foreign policy over that.
Well, in the certainly in the campaign, Barack Obama made the point that it was Afghanistan that should be the central point in the war against terrorism. And clearly, some of the recent suggestions that maybe there's going to be an increased, even more troops going into Afghanistan. This clearly is his war. Afghanistan is Obama's war a lot more than Iraq. Would you acknowledge that? And would you agree with Professor Colucci that this may be a 20-year engagement?
Yes, I would. The National Security Advisor, General Jones, said as much on television this morning. I think we had to go into Afghanistan, whatever our personal preferences might be, because al-Qaeda was sheltered and indirectly launched from there. It was not a war of choice in the same way that Iraq was. I'm very glad that people like Gates and Secretary of Defense Gates and emissary Richard Holbrooke have been talking about the non-military dimensions of success there. I think there are important ways in which Afghanistan is different than Vietnam. There's a lot that's more encouraging about Afghanistan, but I do think we'll be there for a long time.
What is encouraging about Afghanistan?
Throughout the revolution in Vietnam, one had the sense of unified discipline, even though there were big differences between Hanoi and the National Liberation Front in the South. One had a sense of really comprehensive, sustained discipline, willingness to take tremendous casualties in the context of a unified strategy, and finally, tremendous control, a huge black market in the South. Henry Kissinger, before he joined the Nixon White House, was heard to say in a public lecture at Harvard University that he didn't think he was consulting for LBJ for a long period of time. He didn't think that the revolutionaries were that anxious for us to leave because the black market in Saigon was such a huge source of supply for the guerrillas and the North Vietnamese army. We don't have anything like that, neither the centralization nor the kind of comprehensive control that, at least I don't sense, it's in Afghanistan in the same way that it was self-evident in Vietnam.
In looking at all of the regions of the country and all of the world, rather, that we're going to be discussing this evening, we've only talked about North Korea, and now we're talking about Afghanistan. Professor Colucci, it was the 9/11 attacks that really was the foundation upon which you began writing your book, Crusading Realism. Can you look at how the Bush administration, prior to 9/11, looked at Afghanistan and how quickly they gravitated to Afghanistan to begin their war against terrorism?
Well, if you look at it back even in 1997, 1998, before the Bush administration came in with the Clinton administration, you had members of the national security team, people like Richard Clark, but not only him, who were developing plans to ensure that the United States would be prepared to deal with the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And Richard Clark actually developed a plan which he called the Delenda Plan or the Destruction Plan. Al-Qaeda must be destroyed. And that was never listened to. Clark and others were never given the green light. Tenet was another one. He was never given the green light. Now, this ranges from everything from the destruction of the bases and the camps all the way to include things like assassination.
Shut down by whom?
That the United States would have had to shut those down.
No. But you say that Clark and Tenet were warning against this.
Madeleine Albright, okay, and the president himself, probably the vice president.
President
Clinton himself, Vice President Gore, and Secretary Albright in particular. There's numerous quotes. You know, Albright says we can't be dropping bombs on Muslims. And it was kind of that simplistic thought that I think sometimes she was well known for. That got us into that mess. And then when the Bush people came in, they did an analysis and they tried to do an assessment of Afghanistan. And Bush, prior to 9/11, makes statements like, I'm tired of swatting flies. I want to go on the offense. I need to deal with al-Qaeda. That doesn't get really reported in the media very much, but they don't tend to look at the national security documents indicating that. But it was a slow process because you had one administration where you had members of the national security apparatus which are devoted to the protection of national security of the United States that wanted to do something. And then you have politicians often who have a different agenda, and those two did not mix well with the Clinton administration. When the Bush team came in, that's a whole new team with a different set of eyes, having developed new analysis. In fact, when I was in the State Department, the Bush administration issued a need to reevaluate the policy of North Korea, that the Clinton administration had been too soft on the North Koreans. The very statement that they were going to reevaluate that policy threw people into great panic. What does that mean? And it was merely the need to reassess where we were at. Well, they were doing the same thing with Afghanistan and al-Qaeda in particular.
Now, when you look at – we've got an election coming up next week. It looked like Karzai was going to sail to reelection, but now it appears that that may be a competitive race.
Yes, actually, it seems like that the people of Afghanistan have actually taken on this idea of having an election. They really have not had any political institutions for 3 decades.
Been that good, has he?
No, Karzai has not been that good, and he's also got really bad reputation for corruption. His brother seems to have his hand in the tilly in just about every corner of the country, and the people are starting to really resent that. And I think some of the people who used to be with him, like his former foreign minister, Dr. Abdullah, or his former finance minister, Ashraf Ghani, are actually now coming out against them, and they're revealing all of those issues.
Was he our guy?
Oh, yeah.
And is he still our guy?
Sure. The U.S. government supports him. He's the head of a legitimate central authority, which has very little control in the hinterlands. I think it's
is
great.
Is he any good?
He survived a long time. Nobody's been able to oust him or kill him. I think that speaks well of him. His brother is accused of corruption. He himself has not been, as far as I know, formally accused or certainly not indicted. It is not a country with a democratic tradition. There's no great centralization. I think we should focus on what's in the national security interests of the United States. If they have an election, that's great. But I don't think it should be our central concern.
Okay, we're going to be back to talk about that and also move on and talk about Iraq. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont.
Since OnStar began, we've responded to over 100,000 automatic crash alerts.
I'm sorry, emergency. Oh my God! My God, a driver just hit me! Are there injuries? Oh no! Oh no! I can't get out of my truck! I'll get 911 on the line for you.
In a crash, an OnStar advisor can automatically receive an alert.
911.
This is OnStar Emergency. I have a collision on Interstate 12 at exit 59. Called reporting possible injuries. Let me bring them online. I can't move a leg.
We'll send someone out there to help you.
OnStar, are you still with me? Yes, sir. I'll remain on the line with you until the police do arrive. All right.
With automatic crash response, an OnStar advisor can share your exact GPS location and critical crash details with first responders so they're better prepared to help.
The ambulance is coming. Hope everything works out well for you. Please know we're here when you need us.
OnStar is standard for the first year on 14 Chevy models. Visit OnStar.com for details and system limitations.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let me reintroduce our guest for this evening. Art Sear is here. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at the Clawson Center at Carthage College in beautiful Wisconsin, Kenosha, Wisconsin. First time we've had two people from Wisconsin. Professors from Wisconsin. After the Cold War is the name of Art's book, U.S. Policy in Europe and Asia.
Thank you.
Also joining us this evening, making his first appearance, is Lamont Colucci. He is a professor of international relations and national security at Ripon College. That's in Wisconsin. And his new book is called Crusading Realism, The Bush Doctrine and American Core Values After 9/11. Once upon a time, he was in the Foreign Service, attached to South Korea for a while, and then came back to the United States and went into academia. And we thank you very much for joining us tonight. The book has received good reviews from, it's called Crusading Realism, is a deft and scholarly explanation of international affairs in the post-9/11 world. And we're going to continue to talk about that as the program unfolds this evening. Also joining us this evening is Nariman Safavi, and he is an entrepreneur. He is in the diamond mining business. He's looking for responsible diamond mining.
Yes.
And how do you separate responsible diamond mining from irresponsible diamond mining?
Well, we've developed a process for extracting diamonds that has basically four sets of commitments about environmental impact, worker compensation, reinvestment in the community, and the fact that the diamonds have never been used for financing warfare.
Okay, so the opposite of what we all saw in the movie Blood Diamonds.
Exactly the opposite.
You're the good guy in this story.
We're trying to be the good people.
You were born in Tehran. You're an American citizen.
Yes.
You've been a citizen of the United States since the 1980s, and you're a board member of the Iranian American Council.
Yeah, National Iranian American Council.
Very
yes.
good. Speaking of that, we were going to talk about Iraq, and then we're going to talk about Iran. Let's talk about if the Iraq war was George Bush's war and Afghanistan may be Barack Obama's war, where, in your view, do things stand in Iraq right now?
Have we
turned the corner? When history writes the case, are they going to say that the U.S. won the Iraq war?
There seems to be. I don't know if one could make that historical judgment at this point, but it seems like finally the Iraqis are developing the military apparatus to be able to somewhat ensure their own security and the institutions of self-governance to be able to. They finally have a parliament. They seem to have a reasonable level of judiciary. So I think that Iraq might have turned the corner. But as to whether we can declare victory, I would have a problem with that.
Professor Kaluchi, will victory ever be used in the same sentence with Iraq?
Well, I mean, the victory of the war itself was 6 weeks after the war. It was one of the most stunning military victories in American history. So that being said, the issue with the reconstruction, the rebuilding, and the assistance of Iraq to develop a democracy and to develop a civil society, I think will be a victory. And I think it will be seen decades from now in the same light that when we look at countries like Japan. People forget the hard road that the American occupation had, in particular in Japan, even more than in Germany. And they're not completely parallel situations, but they forget that there was the kind of press pieces, the kind of media covers that was going on in 1946 and 1947, talked about Japan and even in Germany as a lost cause, as massive starvation, as massive famine, as massive corruption, refugees, displaced persons. And to suggest that an impatience perhaps there is in the United States that we wanted to go in and we wanted to leave, that really never was the strategy. It never should have been the strategy, and that wasn't the strategy under President Bush. People like to paint the Afghani war as the good war, that we all are behind, and the Iraq war is the bad war. I think actually we're going to see a role reversal in that as we go down the years.
Do you agree with that, Art? A role reversal.
No, I don't. I certainly hope it's right that a prosperous and democratic Iraq emerges down the road. Dwight Eisenhower said right after VE Day, this is not victory in this war, even though Patton's armor and the Wehrmacht set records that compare with the American armored occupation of Baghdad early in the Iraq war. Ike said if a generation from now there are Germans who really respect and indeed embrace democracy, then we'll have won. Throughout the war, if you read the history of the war, there was comprehensive planning by Churchill, Roosevelt, Marshall, and everyone else for the post-war period. One thing I've learned from Bob Woodward's books on the Iraq War, and he had tremendous access, was that Bush, Rumsfeld, and others, including Cheney, felt that once our armor gets to Baghdad, that's it. There was no comprehensive planning for the post-war period, and they admit that themselves. Bush, who continued to meet with Woodward despite Woodward's books were on the White House website for a time. Bush was quite blunt in saying, I had no idea it would be like this. Eisenhower also said, war is the most god-awful endeavor that people undertake. If you don't appreciate that, you don't belong in command. And my view is that Bush should not have been in command.
Your assessment of that, Professor Kaluchi? Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think that the Bush administration and people within the Bush administration had a certain set of preconceived notions about what was going to happen, as they are in every war. And I would say that as far as Japan goes, there was very little comprehensive planning in going in Japan. That's why they were – when they tried to write the Constitution, it was actually about 6 to 10 people that were trying to meet in a room, trying to hammer something out, and then hand it over to the Japanese parliament and use the threat of an American bomber to make sure the parliament passed it in a proper manner. But there's always going to be that. The question, there's going to be always a debate about the implementation of the war. There's going to be debate about the strategy and the tactics of the war. But the fundamental question is, should the United States have removed the Ba'athist dictator of that government? Should they have ended the nightmare for the Iraqi people with Saddam Hussein? Should they have tried to instill and to foster in the Middle East a sense of Arab democracy? And I think on those questions, it's all yes, yes, and yes. And that those are the real substantial questions. If you want to talk in the same light about North Korea, does the United States want to sit by and see the worst human rights abuses in modern history conducted by the worst government? That's much more an interesting question, a better long-term question, than whether or not the North Koreans are developing a particular piece of technology or a particular weapon. And so there are some substructure questions in regards to the Iraq war, and I think that the Bush administration were completely correct.
Earlier in the broadcast, you were talking about debates that were going on in the Clinton administration as to how they should deal with foreign policy and specifically Afghanistan. Take us inside, if you will, because your book, again, starts with the attack on 9/11. You talk about the realists versus the idealists, that the battle that, you know, we may have read a little bit about that battle that was going on within the Bush administration. Take us a little bit deeper into that. Who were the sides and, sure. And what was being brought to George Bush, and how much of George Bush personally was he relying on?
Sure. Well, I think when you look at the foreign policy and the national security decisions of that time, you have to look at it from many dimensions. The first dimension is what the world was doing to the United States, and that's one very interesting question. It was very different than anything any American president ever faced before. I talk in the book about a toxic nexus or a toxic triangle of transnational terrorist groups, WMD, and rogue states. And then you have to look at the ideology of the president and some of his close advisors, and I talk a lot about their views about natural law and the concepts of liberty and dignity and democracy. And then you look at those camps that you were referring to, and you essentially had two basic camps that were fighting each other. And I talk about in the book how they were the serialists and the parallelists. And the serialists were people that wanted to go into Afghanistan and assess victory or success in Afghanistan. And then when that was, quote, finished, they would then decide if they want to move on to someplace else or even if there was another place to move on. The parallelists, led by people like Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, were people that argued that if you do that, you're going to put a finger in the dam somewhere else, and then the water's going to come everywhere else that you're not putting that finger in. You have to be everywhere. And they were advocating very clearly an American response in Somalia, an American response in Yemen, an American response in Iraq. The people who were the serialists, the people who were arguing let's do one thing, were people like Colin Powell and Richard Armitage. Condoleezza Rice was playing the role of arbiter. She didn't really side with one side or the other, definitely not initially. And President Bush at those initial National Security Council meetings, as well as the meetings in Camp David, let the debate go, let it go very far until he finally decided that he would side with the parallelists, would side with the people like Don Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz. But that was, you know, we get this impression that there's a monolith within any administration, and there never is. There's always going to be debates and camps, and ultimately the administration sided with the group that says this has to be a multiple theater war on terror in every place that there's a threat.
Mr. Safavi, as an Iranian American, how did you view the response by the Bush administration to the attack on 9/11?
I thought there was what the Bush administration did with the invasion of Afghanistan was entirely legitimate, and I think the vast majority of the world was actually behind that. It was there was a legitimate self-defense that you had to go there and dismantle the apparatus of that international terrorist network that had basically incubated itself inside of a failed state.
In Iraq?
And Iraq I didn't agree with. I thought that was a war of choice, and that was something that was strategically going to endanger the United States in other places, and it will open up a can of worms that we would not necessarily know what to deal with.
And war of choice is frequently used. Do you agree, war of choice?
Oh, sure. I didn't bring up World War II.
You usually do.
But I'm glad it was. In World War II, the European theater, for good reasons, was given priority, and Eisenhower was able to establish unity of command, which we never had in the Pacific. But throughout the war, we had multiple allies, even at the very beginning, after Pearl Harbor, before Pearl Harbor. We operated under the basis of the United Nations, and there were clear war goals. Those applied to Afghanistan, as they did to the Korean War and the first Gulf War. Iraq was the U.S. going it alone. In fact, the United Nations was opposed to us. We have NATO and U.N. support in Afghanistan. Moreover, there was never clarity to Bush's goals. There have been debates since before the FDR administration on particular conflict areas, but the Bush goals kept changing. First, it's weapons of mass destruction.
On that note,
freedom,
we've got to be back. 1-800-723-8289.
It's the medicine your mom gave you as a kid, the medicine you trusted when you were pregnant. And for many, it's what you rely on to ease arthritis pain. Tylenol has been trusted for over 50 years. And while store brands make pills that look just like Tylenol, it's important to know they're not made by Tylenol. The only way to get the brand you've trusted your whole life, the brand doctors recommend most, is to buy the brand doctors recommend most. Feel better. Tylenol. Use only as directed.
Who's ready to hear some fun facts about GEICO? All right, let's give it a go, shall we? First, over 3 million drivers switched to GEICO last year. Second, GEICO received a customer satisfaction rate of 97%. Third, GEICO has been providing car insurance for over 70 years. Whoa, hold up a tick. These aren't fun facts at all. These are financially sound facts. We've been duped.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Bruce Dumont back, 1-800-723-8289. A war of choice that has been described many times in describing the war in Iraq. Professor Colucci, do you agree with that?
Well, I would agree with it only in the sense that every war is a war of choice, even when you are attacked. So only in that sense. Otherwise, I think there was absolutely no choice whatsoever of the Bush administration. And I realize that's probably a minority of a minority view. I think the Bush administration had essentially no choice to do what they did in Iraq. There were multiple reasons for going into Iraq. The biggest play gets on WMD, and I can assure you from every government document and from every foreign intelligence source, the Bush administration honestly believed, as did the British, as did the Italians, as did the French, that there were WMD stockpiles in Iraq. And what we learned about from the CARE and the Duffler reports that everybody quotes, those same reports that say there were no stockpiles, both of those reports say but Saddam was clearly going to engage in WMD production once the UN sanctions were lifted and they were on the road to be lifted. So if anybody who's going to quote those reports about no stockpiles, that's fine as long as we're willing to take the other half of that report, which is, and yet Iraq was going to do that. So the Bush administration exercised prevention, which is, I see a threat in the horizon, and in order for me to not allow it to become a crisis situation of preemption, I'm going to remove it. But there was a greater issue there. There was, how do we change the dynamic of extremism, of rogue states, and terrorism in the Middle East? And the solution was to bring a sense of democracy and civil society to those people and to assist them.
So those people listening to the program this evening, who are frequent callers to this program,
sure,
who in their heart really believe that George Bush was lying through his teeth and was looking at cooked books and he knew those books were cooked, you say they are wrong.
I would say that they're wrong, and I would go further than that. In every interview that I did with members of the Democratic Party and the national security establishment, not one of them suggested that George W. Bush lied in any way, shape, or form. They vehemently disagreed with him on policy, and they vehemently disagreed with him on the Bush doctrine, and they disagreed with his invasion of Iraq. Yet I could find not a single one of them that would suggest that there was any duplicity on the part of George W. Bush. It doesn't mean you don't agree with him. That's a different story. But no duplicity, none at all.
Art Sear, you were shaking your head as Professor Colucci was speaking.
I think one of President Bush's strongest characteristics and a source of basic support for him until toward the end was that people saw him as a straight shooter, a very straightforward person, a very direct person. What came through to me in the Woodward books is the president was always very sincere in views that were often all over the place and exercised very little strong leadership in staff meetings. People in the administration would talk that way. And again, our goals changed. Nobody doubts, I certainly don't doubt, that WMD were there. I do think the UN regime worked pretty well because they were essentially gone by the time we invaded. But that was, when that didn't work, then we're spreading democracy and then we're fighting al-Qaeda. I think you should be suspicious of an administration that invades and then constantly looks for justification. In each case, the president was sincere, but I don't think he was an effective leader.
reaction to that?
Well, I think as what I talk about in the book for two chapters is that that was always on the agenda. There was never a time that any of those were not on the agenda.
They're all on the agenda, and we stress different things depending on what's been.
That's definitely agreed that there were debates about what to stress to the American people, and the decision was definitely made that WMD was the answer. But if you look at those national security meetings, there were the issues of what is al-Qaeda doing in Iraq, and of course there was no question that there were training in Iraq and there was assistance from the Iraqi government. That's a different than directing al-Qaeda, because again, the media like to confuse that. It became a straw man and a red herring. Then the issue of civil society and democracy.
There was some limited contact before we invaded, but al-Qaeda was not an active force in Iraq in any substantial way before the American attack.
Except that the Iraqi intelligence service was helping to train.
There was some very limited contact between the two, but it was no sustained training exercise.
What George Tenet says in his memoir, the CIA director for President Clinton, when you allow safe haven and when you allow training and when you allow supplies, that's a pretty good indicator of support for a terrorist government,
a terrorist regime.
No, actually, I don't really want to be beat up on the dead horse. I think the history is pretty much, judge that. I think the shifting set of justifications of the Bush administration did not bode well for their sincerity in terms of revealing the truth. And just about everybody that I have spoken to in the intelligence services, they say that the intelligence process was completely politicized. So I'll just leave it at that.
Well, as I say, I think there was a shifting justifications in the public, but there was never shifting justifications within the intelligence community or within the national security establishment.
The CIA was not advocating attacking Iraq. The record is clear.
Except
the CIA
the
was concerned.
Was.
The CIA was very concerned about Afghanistan. Mentioning big names, Secretary Gates is very complimentary to the agency in his memoirs in certain respects. Especially, warning about the dangers of al-Qaeda and the warning about the dangers of a terrorist attack, as is Tim Weiner's book, Legacy of Ashes.
Nariman, what happens next in Iran?
Oh, gosh. Iran, I thought you were going to ask me an easy question. But Iran is going through a very strange kind of a predicament at this point. There have been these show trials put on by the Ahmadinejad administration that are basically a stolen page out of the Stalinist book and methodology, and they're actually very, very disturbing to witness. And we don't know what's going to happen to these mass trials.
Do those who took the streets charging, faulty elections with Ahmadinejad,
yes.
How do they view the United States' response to that? Did they want the United States to do more, say more? And were they disappointed because we acted the way we acted?
I do not hear much of that. I think most people were actually emboldened to take onto the streets because they thought President Obama has finally changed the posture of the United States and is allowing them the freedom in the Iranian political discourse to be able to express dissent against the government. That's because you no longer had that aggressive posture of the Bush administration that had towards Iran, where everything, any sort of a dispute of Ahmadinejad's position would have been interpreted as unpatriotic.
We have got to pause. On that note, I want to thank Nariman Safari, who's been with us in hour number one, Art Sear, also Lamont Colucci, author of the book Crusading Realism. They will all be back for the next hour, because in this hour we have talked about North Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran. We'll talk more about that in the next hour. We'll take your telephone calls, and we're also going to be talking about Pakistan. Some might argue perhaps the biggest tinderbox of all. And also we'll learn a little bit more about the basis of Lamont Colucci's book, Crusading Realism, in our next hour. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, keep the calls coming at 1-800-723-8229. Back shortly. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Since OnStar began, we've answered over 100 million calls for help.
OnStar, sir, how may I help you?
I'm here with a policeman who's taking my report for a stolen vehicle, but I wanted to call you guys immediately to see if you could start searching for it.
Okay. I do apologize about what you're going through here. And do you have that police report number, ma'am?
Yeah, 20.
OnStar has the most comprehensive stolen vehicle service available. We can use GPS technology to pinpoint your stolen vehicle's exact location and work with the police to help recover it.
OnStar, have you located the vehicle?
I do have a location on that stolen vehicle. That's in the National Forest. The lat is showing as 33.7360. The longitude is showing as -111.6589.
Great. The police are on their way right now.
OnStar is standard for the first year on 14 Chevy models.
Yes, this is OnStar. We just wanted to make sure that law enforcement did contact you in reference to your vehicle.
Yes, they did. Thank you so much.
Visit OnStar.com for details and system limitations.
Announcing the Ally Bank Online Savings Account with a great interest rate of 1.7% APY. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account that offers a rate that's among the most competitive in the country. So call Ally at 877-247-ALLY or go to allybank.com. Ally. Straightforward. Member FDIC.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221 for your in-home 60-day risk-free trial. That's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
And now, another reason to switch to GEICO.
Every month, we get lots of letters telling us how much folks like GEICO's claim service. And I quote, "The adjuster assigned to my claim was incredible. He walked me through everything." Then there's this one. GEICO.com is very useful and lets you track your claims. And this. "I filed a claim at 4:15 on Thursday afternoon, and my car was in the shop at 10 a.m. on Friday." And my personal favorite, "Easy Squeezy Lemon Peasy."
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO.
These are tough economic times, so I want you to think about something. Gold. At Goldline is the company you can trust for your gold needs. They've been in business since 1960, so call them today. 877-361-COIN. That's 877-361-COIN. They've been audited from a Big Four accounting firm. Their financials are solid. So call them today for a free investor's kit. 877-361-COIN. You get the free DVD and free shipping on your first order at 877-361-COIN. And remember, goldline.com.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Professor Lamont Colucci of Ripon College, Arthur Sear of Carthage College, an Iranian-born American, Nariman Safari, and an entrepreneur in diamond mining, responsible diamond mining. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Sirius XM Studios in Chicago. Our phone line's open at 1-800-723-8020. What did I say? Responsible diamond mining, right?
You said you said diamond Jim Brady, didn't you?
No, I did.
You almost made it sound like an oxymoron.
I meant to say
diamonds
you're a diamond good guy. Anyway, our phone number is 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv, btb@museum.tv. We do this show. The show is totally scripted, as you can tell. And, again, we thank you very much for joining us for this second hour of the broadcast if you're listening to us on radio, and it's a brand-new broadcast if you're watching us on television. I want to begin with one of our guests. Crusading Realism is the title of a new book. Its author, Lamont Colucci, is here. The subtitle of the book is The Book Doctrine, American Core Values After 9/11. And Lamont, you said in the preface to the book that obviously it was the Twin Towers, it was the attack on 9/11 that really caused you to write this book. But you also said something interesting I want you to sort of elaborate on. You said that when you described it as a significant shift in U.S. foreign policy, the most significant probably in 50 years, and it returned the nation to our Revolutionary War roots.
That's
what did you mean by that?
Well, the core argument and the core concept of the Bush Doctrine, I mean, people talk a lot about policy and they talk about national security strategy and all that's relevant. But when we look at what ideology and what philosophy pushes certain strategies and certain policies, we see that when we talk about containment and deterrence, which was pretty much the national security policy from Truman onwards. The Bush administration realizes that for a lot of reasons, containment and deterrence can't work. President Bush's ideology and President Bush's philosophy is grounded in his thoughts about natural law. And what we see over and over again with President Bush is when he's talking about foreign policy, there's one consistent theme. Now, if I ask audiences when I speak somewhere what that theme is, what I usually get is either with us or against us. He said it. It's not the core theme. The core theme, if you actually look at what he talks about all the time prior to 2001, actually, even when he's governor of Texas, definitely before the 9/11 attacks and consistently immediately after the 9/11 attacks, well before the 2005 inaugural, is that the United States must be on the side that supports human liberty and human dignity. And he likes to say the phrase, the non-negotiable demands of human liberty and human dignity. And what he talks about is the United States and America cannot give democracy to people. They cannot bring democracy to people. What they can do is they can assist people in finding their own way to life, liberty, and property, their own way to finding civil society and democracy. And one of the straw men that gets to be built is, does that mean the Bush administration was all about having elections and look what happened in Gaza? And the answer is no, it wasn't. Because if you don't have civil society, you don't have any rule of law, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have any kind of sense of elections. So this idea of our Revolutionary War roots, it's almost amazing that it took over 200 years for the United States to really begin to adopt that in a formalized way, that American foreign policy should be guided first and foremost by one concept, that American foreign policy should do whatever it can to promote for other people life, liberty, and property, those natural law concepts that our Revolutionary War was founded on.
Art Sear, in your view, how did the Bush Doctrine and 8 years of George Bush as President of the United States, how has it affected our standing in the world?
Well, President Bush, as a leader in the administration, were undeniably unpopular in the world. I'm not sure how much it was a function of his doctrine, though. Presidents tend to have doctrines. We had a Truman Doctrine and an Eisenhower Doctrine and a Nixon Doctrine and a Reagan Doctrine, and there's probably a Carter Doctrine, but nobody was listening much. I'm not being glib, I hope. Presidents make these declarations. The Truman Doctrine had a big impact in terms of, I think, taking our perspective.
But what about Bush in the world?
Well, take it when you have we all I think agree that the president has emphasized different points at different times. You'd agree with that.
I think there's been public, except for this non-negotiable demands of human liberty and human dignity. That's a consistent theme that even predates his presidency.
You're either with us or against us, of course, was right after 9/11, and in many ways it was understandable. I think the president got very high marks after he reappeared the second day after the attacks. He was very unilateral in his first term. In his second term, he emphasized the six power talks in dealing with North Korea, which is one reason why John Bolton, already isolated by then, became very strident in his public attacks on President Bush, which continue. So I think the president really embraced multilateralism in his second term, which since the Second World War has been the way we've been effective in the world.
When he was talking about the axis of evil, though, Iran and Iraq and North Korea and Afghanistan, when you heard him include the country where you were born.
Yes.
Although you are an American citizen.
Yes.
When you heard him include that country in an axis of evil, at that moment in time, did you say, yes, he's right, or why is he expanding this list?
Actually, you are pointing at a very particular moment in my life where I had gone back for the first time in 25 years to Iran, 2 days before he made that speech. And I was actually, when I was talking to Iranians, some people who were on the reformist side of the Iranian politics, they had just gone out on a limb to cooperate with the United States on the invasion of Afghanistan. Some of the bases on the eastern part of Iran, in the Khorasan province, were actually being used, were getting prepped to treat American GIs who were getting wounded in Afghanistan to be brought over there and to be treated. Very hush-hush they were all about it. And they had gone out on a limb against the conservatives in Iran to say that we need to use this opportunity to cooperate with the United States and defeat this terrorism. And then a few days later, he comes back and he does the payback to the reformists of Iran by including him into the axis of evil. And people were coming to me and saying, what the hell happened to this guy? How could he screw us like this? And this was just a shocking moment in Iran.
Tehran, that's a very interesting point. Tehran has given over $400 million in aid to the central government in Afghanistan, which is real money, more or less. They're also strongly opposed to the drug trade. And I've been very glad that the Obama administration, even the Bush people made some noises, I'm very glad Obama has been more interested in developing some kind of working alliance with
Afghanistan. But coming with that, so, take us inside the listing of those four nations, which he described as terrorist state, the axis of evil. How did they get picked out? How did that get thrown into that speech? Because that clearly was part of your either with us or against us mindset.
I think that, well, first of all, that wasn't the original phrase of the speech.
And you know what? I shouldn't have asked the question because we got to go to a break. I'll give
you
a chance
to
think
of a good answer.
And we'll be back. 1-800-723-8289. We've got some callers on the line. We'll bring them into the conversation as well. And also, before the end of the broadcast this evening, we're going to be talking about perhaps the diciest nation of all that we have to deal with, and that's Pakistan. Back shortly.
Individual results may vary. Program not available in all states. See contract for complete terms.
If your credit card debt is out of control, if you're in over your head dealing with monthly payments, there is powerful information you need to know about the government's bailout of credit card companies. If you have more than $10,000 in credit card debt, you have the right to settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe with monthly payments you can afford. Credit card companies have been given billions and need to clean their books once and for all. And that's great news for you. We're Credit Answers, and we'd like to offer you free information that will show you how to settle your credit card debt with payment plans customized for you. It's yours free by calling 1-800-400-5439. Don't declare bankruptcy. Give us 10 minutes and learn how we have saved our clients millions. Live better, debt-free. For free information on how to settle your credit card debt in a government bailout era, call 1-800-400-5439. That's 1-800-400-5439. 1-800-400-5439.
From Bakersfield, California to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Lamont Colucci is here from Ripon College. And by the way, if you're listening around the country and you're saying, why is he saying Ripon College? It's Ripon College. Well, I was told before the broadcast that it's called Ripon. Ripon College.
Like,
you've been there for
cookies.
5 years, yeah. And it is the birthplace of the Republican Party, allegedly, at least according to the Ripon Society.
To people who really do their scholarly work, yeah, it's actually the birthplace of the Republican Party.
And it was back in 1854.
1854, right? Yeah, that's right.
1854. Yeah. Now, before the break, you were going to explain the use of the term the axis of evil that George Bush put into that speech, addressed to the nation, where it came from.
Sure.
And there are many people who believe that you know, one you know, paragraph you know, poisoned the well for the United States throughout the world.
Well, I think if you look at the diplomatic community's reaction, it was mostly negative. And if you look at, probably there were many people in the United States Congress, it was in some places probably negative. The original phrase was the axis of hatred, and that was the phrase that David Frum wrote when he was writing the speech. But President Bush actually crossed that out, and he inserted the word evil itself. So I think that gives us a little vignette and maybe his mindset. And so I think what shocked people is an American president – Lincoln used the word quite frequently, evil. But American presidents in the very modern age, in the so-called postmodern age in particular, have shied away from the term. I mean, people were shocked even when Reagan used the term evil empire to describe the Soviet Union. So I think what we need to pause and say, what do we mean by that? What do we mean by evil? Why would you call North Korea evil? I think if you look at countries that abuse their population, commit state-sponsored types of genocide or have concentration camps – or engage in massive amounts of criminal activity and human trafficking and narcotics and counterfeiting and proliferation of weapons and the state sponsorship of terrorism, then that becomes evil, because what you're really doing is you're harming people. You're harming innocent people. And it's probably even more reprehensible when you're harming your own people. And how abhorrent what some of these regimes do to their own people. And for a president of the United States to stand up and say, this is intolerable according to American values, the very values that we were talking about regards to the American Revolution, I think shouldn't be shocking. And maybe the shocking aspect of this is the shock in when he said it. And that maybe is unfortunate.
You use the term toxic nexus.
Right.
Is toxic nexus the same thing of what you've just described?
Oh, sure it is. But I think the idea, the toxic nexus, which is weapons of mass destruction, and we don't just mean the weapons themselves. We mean the development, the chain of supplies, the engineering, and everything that goes along into making them, and not just a physical weapon. We talk about transnational terrorist groups that cross boundaries and don't appeal maybe to a specific ethnic area or a specific cause like Eitan, Spain, or the FARC in Colombia. And we talk about rogue states, states that engage in terrorism and in genocide and in concentration camps and in human trafficking and narcotics and counterfeiting. Those are not normal states. Those are states that have gone beyond the pale and are unacceptable in the international regime as well as in the eyes of the United States.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Line 5. Perry is listening to us on in La Salle, Peru, on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask a question. I don't know the gentleman's name that wrote the book about the weapons of mass destruction and that, but
Lamont Colucci, it's called Crusading Realism. It's a soft-cover book.
Okay, now, this was the book, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and Mr. Bush is supposed to have been had the idea that they were really there. And before the war even started, Hans Blix was on the ground, along with Scott Ritter, doing the inspection over there, said there was no evidence at that time that he had ever engaged in any of those weapons of mass destruction. Secondly, there was a story put out by Seymour Hersh at about the same time who said that it was a facade put up by the people in Iraq and the military. Now, if the people on the ground inspected this, wouldn't you think that their ideas and what they find out would be more true than a bunch of political disc jockeys?
Let's let Lamont respond.
Well, of course, before Ritter had his conversion, he was on the opposite end of that coin. He was advocating much more stronger sanctions and much more stronger activity against Iraq. Then he suddenly had a conversion and he went 180 degrees. Blix always said that there had been duplicity by the Iraqis because they would play games about when they could visit, where they could visit, how they could visit, who could visit. And that was a game that the Iraqis were constantly engaged in. Every intelligence service in the West confirmed the idea that the Iraqis were on their way to redeveloping their WMD program, whether that be MI6 in Britain, whether that be the CIA in the United States. But most importantly, when we look at the issue of WMD, is Saddam Hussein himself. And what was admitted to by the Ba'athists and by Saddam Hussein is that they were engaged in a three-level policy. One policy to the United Nations, one to the U.S., and one to the Iranians. To the Iranians, we have WMD. We're ready to use them at a moment's notice. To the United Nations, we don't have WMD, and we're not even engaged in any type of development program. And to the United States, ambiguity. So you combine the fact that the Western intelligence services were saying that, you combine the fact that the Iraqis themselves had a need to portray their WMD program as farther along, and you obviously have the result that the United States felt there was. But I point back to those two reports. The same two reports that confirmed that there were no stockpiles also say that the intent was there to renew it.
Art?
Well, we know he had weapons of mass destruction at times in the past, including highly sophisticated weapon that we supplied when he was our ally in the 80s.
That's why we knew he had it.
At that time. Richard Nixon in Beyond Peace, published in 1994, one of the numerous books he wrote after he was forced from office, wrote very explicitly, and I commend this to you, Saddam Hussein will drive you crazy. Iraq is a very annoying nuisance power. But I assure you, wrote Nixon a decade before the American attack, if we attack Iraq, it'll be a quagmire for reasons that go beyond the usual problems of war and will do nothing but reinforce the regional role of Iran. Iraq under Saddam as a secular nation. He's a modernizer. He stands apart from secular Islam, which is supporting these Islamic fundamentalist terrorist groups. I can't emphasize enough the importance of looking to history, not because I'm so smart, but because there are lessons there that are self-evident if you'll only take the time.
Nirman.
Well, yes. I think that, Nixon was one of the most brilliant people to ever occupy the White House.
And I think, along with Clinton, and they both did
exactly.
themselves.
Exactly, and he was definitely very prescient on that. And I think that this whole thing about the role of Iran having expanded in the region was a little bit overblown. And I think there is some people who are who have incentives to want to try to overplay that. I don't think the government in Iran is shrewd enough or competent enough to be able to capitalize on that opportunity that George W. Bush has created for Iran.
Mm. If I could just add, I think you're right. Nixon, I'm sure, would have said something like that. And then, of course, that's why the Bush Doctrine has nothing to do with the Nixon Doctrine or the Nixon administration. And that is, do we want to have a foreign policy like the Nixon administration that's it's based on a calculus of what is good or bad in some tangible, concrete ways that supposedly further the interests of the United States economically or politically? Or do we want a foreign policy that's based on the conditions of human rights and liberty. And liberty is the central question.
Let's go to Chris in Palatine, Illinois on WLS. You're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen, good evening. I wonder if this whole mess that we're in right now in the world really could be traced back to the early 1980s when the Reagan administration decided to fund through the CIA an insurgent movement in Afghanistan to defeat the Russians. And isn't that really what we're facing today? Aren't we sowing reaping what we've sowed back then?
Well, you've got a realist policy engaged. You have a policy that says the Soviet Union moved X and the United States will move Y. The Carter administration had the very groundwork of dealing with the Soviet Union, and the Reagan administration increased that to a full-out support for a counterinsurgency against the Soviets.
Right, but, I understand
and,
that.
But that's realism, and that's exactly what the Bush administration was trying to get us out of in a different cycle.
Well, I think the whole problem came down to is that, you know, an ideology – I mean, we basically awoken a sleeping giant in this Islamic, terrorist movement. You really didn't have the mass terrorists that you had. I mean, back in the 70s, you had the Black September and some of those other Palestinian groups, but they were much more professional than these guys are today. You didn't have Osama bin Laden. You didn't have Taliban. You didn't have Al-Qaeda. You know, and I think that's all been created. And I think 50 years from now, we will look back at this and what the right wing views as the greatest triumph of Reagan, I think, will be one of the greatest defeats for the West.
I don't think that's true at all. We Americans are essentially a wonderful country and a moral country. Like most people in the world, except especially in our case, because we have this commitment to freedom and we're so rich and so strong, we tend to think we can influence events more than we can. Professor Colucci is absolutely right. Carter and Brzezinski really initiated the very effective insurgency against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. Given the brutality of the Soviet occupation, there are moral issues involved. I think Islamic fundamentalism is not there because the United States invaded Afghanistan. There are much larger trends going on in the world.
Nuri?
Actually, I have a personal recount of an encounter with the current president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, who actually used to live in Chicago. And mm-hmm. I remember him at one time when he was in Chicago saying that when he approached and people like him who were more secular in Afghanistan, Afghani politics, and they were actually more liberal and more enlightened, said that when we approach United States offices, whether it's the CIA or the State Department, they don't want to have anything to do with us. They always want to support every two-bit thug terrorist and religious nutcase or a gangster because they think they will be much more effective in Afghanistan in fighting the Russians than us educated liberals will be. And it took 9/11 for the United States to finally come back and realize that these are the right people to support in Afghanistan.
All right, when we come back, I'm going to talk about the right people to support in Pakistan, 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight from coast to coast and border to border.
With welcome rewards from Hotels.com, you get a free night after accumulating 10 nights with any of their partner hotels.
So Hotels.com is telling me to sleep around.
Exactly. Stay at a boutique, a national chain, anywhere. Sleep around.
Is that ethical?
Of course. Who wouldn't want you to sleep around?
My wife.
With Hotels.com, she can sleep around too.
What did you say?
You know what? That didn't come out right.
Accumulate 10 nights, even at different hotels, and earn a free night. Welcome rewards from Hotels.com. Smart. So smart. Some restrictions apply. See site for details.
Shaquille O'Neal for Icy Hot.
I need pain relief that won't mess with my grip.
The new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator. Powerful, targeted, long-lasting pain relief now in a roll-on applicator. No mess. Just maximum strength medicine for back, shoulders, knees, even arthritis. Massages in icy to dull the pain, hot to relax it away.
Wherever I hurt, wherever I go.
Stop pain right at the source with the new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator.
No pain, no mess.
For temporary topical pain relief, use only as directed.
From Texarkana, Texas to Columbia, South Carolina, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on some of America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. Nice to have you with us tonight. Art Sear joins us this evening. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at the Clawson Center, that is at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Also from with us this evening is Lon Colucci. He is a professor of international relations and national security at Ripon College. That's in Ripon, Washington.
Wisconsin.
And he is author of the new book called Crusading Realism, The Bush Doctrine and American Core Values After 9/11. And also joining us this evening is Nariman Safari, and he is an Iranian-born American. And he specializes in socially responsible for responsible diamond mining in West Africa, and a board member of the Iranian American Council. And what is the Iranian American Council?
National Iranian American Council, NIAC, as it's called, NIAC, is the largest grassroots organization of Iranian Americans. We're basically an education and advocacy group. Based in Washington, D.C., but we have chapters all over the country. Thousands and thousands of Iranian Americans are members. And we basically try to do advocacy work on behalf of Iranian Americans in Washington, D.C., and also do citizenship education, where we teach Iranian Americans to register to vote and to try to how to engage your congressman and how to talk to your senator and how to become better civil participants in the American society.
Okay. Thus far this evening, if you've been listening to the entire broadcast, we've talked about North Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and I've said a couple of times during the broadcast that perhaps one of our diciest relationships might be Pakistan. Do you agree with that, Art?
Yes, one of our most important.
Where would you put it on 1 to 10 as a problem nation, if you will, for the United States to address? Where would you put it on the scale?
I don't think it's a principal problem nation for us. They're currently an ally. They're a very important nation for us, and I would put them in a different category with the axis of evil we were discussing. I'm so glad you've been emphasizing the importance of history consistently. John Foster Dulles spent his time as Secretary of State going around the world trying to reproduce NATO. It did not take root, but the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, which he established, was anchored in the West in Pakistan because it's such an important military power. The British Army trained the Pakistani Army. They've been important for us during the Cold War and since. They also, of course, a nuclear weapons state with a major fundamentalist movement for all kinds of reasons, which Afghanistan and al-Qaeda only reinforced. They're of crucial strategic importance to us. And there is, dating back to Ike and Dulles, there is an undercurrent of cooperation, especially between the military, that I think is... The news is always bad, but I think that's very encouraging for us.
What is a happy ending there, Dr. Colucci?
Well, a happy ending in Pakistan, I suppose, is the continued development of civil society and democracy. And I think that just that basic question is what we've been talking about. Do we engage in a policy that's supporting a strongman? There have been strong men in Pakistan. President Zia is probably a typical example of that. Musharraf was sort of that way, although he's more of a transitional figure. And the State Department and the United States were hanging a lot of their hat on Benazir Bhutto, and al-Qaeda ensured and their affiliates ensured that that wasn't going to happen. Not that she would have been a panacea, because I think in America we do a little bit too much of that. You know, it's the – if it's, you know, Gorbachev or Yeltsin, it's more complex than often a single leader. But that is the happy ending, and that's going to be a happy ending that's going to be decades, if not longer. And there has to be patience involved on the American side.
The rise of women, especially since there are four males sitting around the table here, and I'm not just seeking favor with the audience, the rise of women, especially in Islamic countries and especially in Africa, is one of the most promising developments for a civil society. And the fact that not just in Pakistan, you were so right to mention Mrs. Bhutto, tragic though her death was, but the example that these women represent in India, the Philippines, Indonesia, Liberia, it's just phenomenal, this change, which is quite recent and means the world is moving in our law-abiding direction. So we want strong men, but we want strong women too.
But when you look at your comment about Pakistan.
Well, Pakistan, I think one of the positive things about Pakistan is that it seems like that with what has happened with the Pakistani Taliban, the average Pakistani seems to have switched a little bit mentally in their attitude, that they have now started to perceive the Pakistani Taliban as the real security threat and not India as much. And that bodes very well for the long-term prospects of ultimately there being some sort of a settlement of the Pakistani-Indian conflict and the Pakistani military and the national resources of Pakistan focusing on issues of building the country from within.
Now, over the years, when you're looking at it politically, is it too simple to say that Republican administrations have tended to be more favorable to Pakistan and Democratic administrations have tended to be more favorable to India? Is that either one of
Actually, President Kennedy went out of his way to cultivate Ayub Khan, the dictatorial strongman in a much more brutal and ruthless era from my point of view. He was one of his first visitors to Washington, and Kennedy was always quick and well-briefed. When you read the history of their encounter, it was really quite remarkable, whereas India used to drive us crazy in those days, holier than thou, even worse than the Swedes, lecturing us constantly. And that president would send Jackie to deal with Nehru, not just because the macho guys in Washington at that time didn't care much for the Indian approach stylistically, but also because Nehru was constantly creating friction for the United States. So, when you look at history, I don't think that was true.
You know, I think that the Bush administration, which uses a launching pad what was done under President Clinton with the Indian relationship and the realization that the United States must form a strategic alliance with India permanently, there has to be greater cooperation militarily, there has to be greater cooperation economically, there has to be greater cooperation technologically, that the Indians, as the largest population as far as democracy goes, as well as being on the front line of the attacks by groups like al-Qaeda, Jamaat Islamiya, and others, Lashkar-e-Taiba, all these Islamic groups that have the Indians in their crosshairs in many ways more so than even the United States. These are things that the Bush administration realized and pushed forward, and one would hope that would be continued under the Obama administration.
Yeah. When you
and that's, when they were Republicans. Excuse me. After
sure.
Eisenhower went to India in office, but he was the last American president for literally decades.
Your comment?
Yeah, if I may, I think regardless of Democratic or Republican, all American administrations since the mid-1970s have pretty much given the Pakistani military the license to do whatever it wants to do because it was considered to be a reliable ally in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And ever since President Bhutto in Pakistan in 1977 was executed by General Ziaur Haq, who later on became the president and became basically the military strongman. The Pakistani military has been pretty much doing whatever it wants, hollowing out the country's institutions, whether it was the parliament, whether it's the independence of the judiciary. So the country now has no educational system to speak of, no real independent judiciary. It doesn't even control the entire territory that it is supposedly it's a sovereign on.
But they are having elections. And Musharraf, you know, essentially was defeated and stepped down. We don't have constant coups anymore. Would you grant that?
That is a positive development. I grant you that. But I still think that Pakistan is still nevertheless is paying for what we did to it during the Cold War.
Isn't it a significant feeding ground for Al-Qaeda and Taliban and obviously terrorist thinking of all the countries we've talked about? Is that one of the true tinderboxes?
Oh, I think
because they also have nuclear weapons already.
That is one of our biggest vulnerabilities on our struggle against the global terrorism.
Dr. Colucci, when you were preparing to research Crusading Realism, you interviewed a lot of people. What was the general attitude, and how easy was it for you to get the information upon which to base your book?
That's a good question.
Well, I think some people were very approachable, and I would note, for example, former CIA Director Jim Woolsey and Bill Kristol and people like that were very approachable. Other people were a little more difficult, and I think that when you're trying to do a book and you don't just want to base it on secondary sources or even primary government documents, when you want to actually talk to the people that were helping to orchestrate or plan, in this case, the Bush Doctrine, or feed the ideology or form as a foundation. Or in many cases, I interviewed people that were on the opposite side of the aisle. They were against the Bush Doctrine, and they didn't like what the foreign policy was. And I needed to get their perspective to see how that gelled with what was coming out on the other side. But that's the one part of the book that I view as the most original, in that there are people from the Clinton administration, there are people from the first Bush administration, there are people from the George W. Bush administration, and they all have a different take in almost all areas except for one, and that's the one we talked about, and that is that when people who were pro-Bush doctrine, anti-Bush doctrine agree that Bush's worldview and this view that we were talking about in regards to natural law really is something that President Bush believes from, I think, a personal level, from a religious level, from a philosophical level. And I think some people, for sure, are a little bit uncomfortable with that, because that's not put into the public square, to use Richard John Neuhaus's famous phrase. It's not something in the public square in a modern American's mind when an American president uses those terms. And I talk about how you have to go back to Theodore Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln to get that kind of language and that kind of justification in the American presidency.
And you also, to underscore something you said earlier in the broadcast, you said even those who are critical of the Bush Doctrine, even known liberals or Democrats, no one said they believed that George Bush lied to the American people.
Not one person that I interviewed, and they were all in the national security establishment, either Republicans or Democrats, felt that way, even if they were vehemently opposed to it.
Very interesting. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Since OnStar began, we've answered over 100 million calls for help.
OnStar Center, how may I help you?
I'm here with a policeman who's taking my report for a stolen vehicle, but I wanted to call you guys immediately to see if you could start searching for it.
Okay. I do apologize about what you're going through here. And do you have that police report number, ma'am?
Yeah, 20.
OnStar has the most comprehensive stolen vehicle service available. We can use GPS technology to pinpoint your stolen vehicle's exact location and work with the police to help recover it.
OnStar, have you located the vehicle?
I do have a location on that stolen vehicle. That's in the National Forest. The lat is showing as 33.7360. The longitude is showing as -111.6589.
Great. The police are on their way right now.
OnStar is standard for the first year on 14 Chevy models.
Yes, this is OnStar. We just wanted to make sure that law enforcement did contact you in reference to your vehicle.
Yes, they did. Thank you so much.
Visit OnStar.com for details and system limitations.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone numbers. We'll take a call in just a moment, but I want to get quick reaction to a New York Times story today. It says climate change seen as a security threat, and according to an exercise at the National Defense University, they've looked into global warming and climate change as a obviously we know that people view it as an environmental concern affecting the world, but now it's viewed as a national security threat. Anybody at the table agree with that?
Do you have a clear sense of what
they
mean?
Well, they basically say that the changing global climate will pose profound strategic challenges to the United States in coming decades, raising the prospect of military intervention to deal with the effects of violent storms, drought, mass migration, pandemics, according to military
unrest.
And intelligence experts. Climate-induced crisis could topple governments, feed terrorist movements, or destabilize entire regions, according to this report. Your reaction?
I think we're living in an era where we're starting to redefine what national security means and going beyond the classic definition. I was recently heard a panel here in Chicago where people were talking about some people from the Pentagon and people from other government institutions were talking about the financial crisis that we're having being considered as a national security issue, the global financial crisis, as it causing unrest and causing states to fail, and then what we will do in that. So we're actually living in an era where I think we're redefining the concept of national security.
You agree with that?
Well, I think, you know, in national security studies and national security, we define any threat to two threats. We have vital threats and national threats. And a vital threat is anything that questions the existence of the United States. And a national threat is anything that questions aspects of our alliances, our economic system, our trading partners, our geopolitical or geostrategic location that we need. Obviously, if those things are – those things would fit that definition and whether or not – I think on the other hand, we need to avoid the de jure aspect of things, meaning for a while it was terrorism and now it's going to be climate change. And 4 years from now it might be failed states and then we're going to see another cycle.
Or obesity.
But, well, sure.
Failed obesity.
But I think in international relations and national security, we have to always go back to the old stock, which is great power conflict. And that trumps everything else, in my opinion. I think it always will. I think we'll never be in an age where great power conflict will not be at the top of the pyramid. It may not be the sexiest thing to talk about because it's not the thing that's going on right now.
But. In reintroducing you a short time ago, I mentioned that once upon a time you worked for the State Department, and off the air, you were sharing with the other guests that you worked, was it the World Desk, or you worked on a
watch,
on
a
watch desk.
For a while I was
what
a
exactly
watch
does that mean? Because it was fascinating to hear your description of your previous job.
Well, you analyze what's going on in the world on a daily basis, and you attempt to sift through events and alerts and changes and events and try to ferret out if there's something important.
And how many people are on this desk?
It could be as few as two. It could be four. And you have people above you, and your basic job, you're given a certain portfolio. You might be looking at everything, dealing with narcotics, dealing with terrorism, dealing with Russia, dealing with China, whatever. And you take that and say, here's an event or happening that has occurred. Somebody needs to see this. Somebody needs to deal with this. Maybe you have to make some spot analysis and deal with it. It's kind of like being hooked up to a fire hose and 98%.
And you have odd hours. You have weird hours. Too.
Strange hours of shifts because the world needs to have some consistency even with the people. So that's right. Sometimes it'd be a 12-hour situation.
I'm gonna ask a question that could probably take 2 hours, but I do want to ask it given your background. And Art, I think you've been on this program and we've discussed this before. But when early in the Afghan war, when the stories that were in the paper that we were reading about was that the United States was on the verge or being in a position basically to destroy all the poppy fields in Afghanistan, and the United States decided not to do it, I asked on this program, why when we had this opportunity, why did we not do that? You alluded to narcotics, as one of the issues that you might look at. What is the answer to that question, coming from your background as an academic, as someone who worked in the State Department? Why would the United States not destroy the poppy field in Afghanistan if they had that opportunity 7 years ago?
Well, I think you have to ask the question of what are you replacing it with? I mean, you have a sector of the Afghani farming population that relies on it as a cash crop, as strange as that might sound to an American. And what do you replace that? How do you ensure that these people can survive and have an income? Now, there are probably answers to that. There are answers we could probably come up with for that. But I mean, there has to, you do something like that, and the famous phrase of blowback is there. Now you own it. You own all those people that were subsisting on that income. That doesn't necessarily justify the fact that we shouldn't have had a plan maybe to deal with that. But you have to recall that the Taliban had a very interesting policy towards narcotics. They made the public and the world believe they were against them, but they were all for selling them to the West. And they actually increased the amount of opium production for sale to the West, primarily through Russia. And so that system of economics is there. You have to find something to replace it with. It's the same thing that exists in South America and Central America. You eradicate the coca fields, you better have something to replace so these people can feed their families.
So then basically to follow up on what your point is, because the Bush administration, we know, did not necessarily have all of their act together as it related to the war in Iraq, because there were many things they didn't figure out and, frankly, they didn't do very well. When you're looking at the war in Afghanistan, it seems to me, judging from what you just said, is that one of the significant things they didn't think about was to have an answer to that real question, which means that one of the reasons why poppies are growing wildly again in Afghanistan is because the Bush administration could have stopped it, and they chose not to.
But that wasn't the strategic reason for the war. I mean, the strategic reason for the war in Iraq was to remove Saddam Hussein and change the venue. The strategic reason in Afghanistan was to remove the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Those two things were successful, in fact, on a grand scale.
You know what? I've opened a can of worms here, but we can't finish it, okay? Yeah. We'll come back and get your response to that. I should have asked that a little bit earlier in the broadcast, but I want to thank our guests. Nariman Safavi, thank you very much for being
with us
from the Iranian-American Council. Art Sear from Carthage College, and Lamont Colucci from Ripon College, and also author of the new book, Crusading Realism. It is a softcover book. It is available on Amazon.com. And again, based on the last couple of hours, I think offering a different perspective to the discussion of U.S. foreign policy and the Bush administration. And for those conservatives out there who are tired of hearing liberals say that George Bush lied, read the book. You heard him say it twice tonight on our broadcast. I'm Bruce Dumont. We'll see you next week.
Individual results may vary. Program not available in all states. See contract for complete terms.
If your credit card debt is out of control, if you're in over your head dealing with monthly payments, there's powerful information you need to know about the government's bailout of credit card companies. If you have more than $10,000 in credit card debt, you have the right to settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe with monthly payments you can afford. Credit card companies have been given billions and need to clean their books once and for all. And that's great news for you. We're Credit Answers, and we'd like to offer you free information that will show you how to settle your credit card debt with payment plans customized for you. It's yours free by calling 1-800-400-5439. Don't declare bankruptcy. Give us 10 minutes and learn how we have saved our clients millions. Live better, debt-free. For free information on how to settle your credit card debt in a government bailout era, call 1-800-400-5439. That's 1-800-400-5439. 1-800-400-5439.
It's the medicine your mom gave you as a kid. The medicine you trusted when you were pregnant. And for many, it's what you rely on to ease arthritis pain. Tylenol has been trusted for over 50 years. And while store brands make pills that look just like Tylenol, it's important to know they're not made by Tylenol. The only way to get the brand you've trusted your whole life, the brand doctors recommend most, is to buy the brand doctors recommend most. Feel better. Tylenol. Use only as directed.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221. For your in-home 60-day risk-free trial, that's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
Reason number 48 to switch to Geico.
As much as you enjoy the experience, you won't have to go to the post office. We can automatically debit your checking account or even charge your premium to your credit card. It's easy and you never have to worry about mailing your car insurance premium again. But we must warn you, you won't get to use any postage stamps. I hear they're coming out with some pretty cool designs.
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
These are tough economic times, so I want you to think about something. Gold. At Goldline is the company you can trust for your gold needs. They've been in business since 1960, so call them today. 877-361-COIN. That's 877-361-COIN. They've been audited from a Big Four accounting firm. Their financials are solid. So call them today for a free investor's kit. 877-361-COIN. You get the free DVD and free shipping on your first order at 877-361-COIN. And remember, goldline.com.